Saving money in your next painting project now at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect finish for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. Save big on Dutch Boy paints. Plus, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and get your painting project started today. Save big money
at Menards. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the 21CD podcast. As always, I'm your ghost, John. If this is your first time here, welcome. And all my OGs, thank you for your continued support. I see you. I've recognized your efforts all year long, your support throughout the entire year, and it's always a pleasure to see you in the comments. It's Christmas, so merry, merry, ho, ho. But also, I don't expect a lot of you guys to listen to this episode, so I'm going to take this opportunity to save myself a little bit of time so I can also spend some time with my family, and I'm just going to say thank you to all of you guys. You guys have been such a blessing this year. This podcast has been a blessing, and it's been a great year. We've grown exponentially more than I ever expected to over the course of the past year, and there's a lot of new faces even coming in just from the past couple weeks, you know. And it's pretty much gotten to the point where I don't really have to do anything on this podcast because you guys keep it growing constantly, and I would not have been able to do that without, you know, all of you guys coming to my side of dystopia and just seeing what's up. So rock on, guys. Solid year. Thank you. A special shout out and thank you to my very, very good friends over at Merkle Media. Whether it's, you know, Tony, Jack, Joel, all of them over there have been great friends to make in this space and, you know, just in life in general. Fantastic people, and they were very influential in convincing me that I should have a podcast in the first place, and then in supporting me as I found my voice and brought this podcast into the matrix. In 2025, we are going to have some insane upgrades for the channel. There's going to be a lot of fun stuff happening. We're going to start releasing members' privileges some way or another. We're going to start having special spaces for the OGs. There's going to be a lot of bonus content that comes out, and we're going to release at least one movie next year, and most likely go on one of the most insane expeditions I will probably ever do in my life. No doubt it will, hopefully, if I can make it happen, eclipse the Icelandic trip that I recently came back from. More on that to come next year. But this year I am going to bring myself as close to death as possible to discover something that I think is out there, that I believe is out there. And I don't care what it takes. Something very big is coming. And I also want to take this time to explain why I have been a little bit more absent in the comments on my videos on YouTube. I do apologize for that. Just know that I read every single comment. My followers need to understand, though, as social media grows, strangers come from all different walks of life, and their goal is to dismantle your peace. And I have been attempting to build peace for a very long time. I've been experiencing an influx of hate, though, in my comments, and I've been an angry man in my history. So to avoid becoming an angry man in my present, I sometimes do not participate in the comments so that I can spare myself the rage that I experience as I read the most idiotic, nonsensical, closed-minded, new world propagandized, echo chambered bullshit that I have ever heard from these haters. And it's not because I forget any of you, so don't forget, you know, none of your comments aren't worthy of response. Your comments are worthy of response. It's just theirs that aren't worth response, and this is the one response that they will get from me. and we let it go. I need to protect my sanity because there's just already too much other stuff taking priority up here. And I have some memory loss problems and some issues remembering things, and I don't need the toxicity or to be knocked off my axis. This episode is in dedication to my haters, though, as a matter of fact, while we're on the matter of haters. Most of my haters from 2024 were due to the fact that I drank liquid death in a number of my videos. I would like to confirm to all of you that as of my last check, I have spent over $3,000 this year on just liquid death. I drink it because it's delicious and because it has completely killed my addiction to soda, energy drinks, beer, and alcohol of all types. So you can count that as a win, or you can count that as witchcraft. It's whatever you want. I really don't care. All these losers love to point out the branding and how satanic and evil this water allegedly is. So to the haters, today we're going to talk about one of your favorite holidays that I'm sure you partake in some way, great or small, every single year. So hey, everybody, welcome to the 21CD podcast. We're going to talk a little bit about Santa Claus. Did you know the Grand Temple of Artemis in Ephesus, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, stands tall with its marble columns piercing the Anatolian sky? But beneath this sprawling monument, some say there's a secret, and there are the bones of Saint Nicholas, who is, of course, who inspired Santa Claus. Here's how the story twists. When Nicholas, who was the Bishop of Myra, passed away in the 4th century, he was interred in a modest tomb in the church of his city. Myra was a small but powerful place, and they held on to the saint. But centuries later, as the Seljuks pushed into Asia Minor, the relics of Nicholas became prime targets for Christian looters, disguised as protectors. And in 1087 AD, sailors from Bari are said to have stolen his bones and whisked them away to Italy. That's the official line, anyway. That's what we are led to believe happened. But whispers from the fringes tell a little bit of a different tale, one that links Saint Nick not to the Christian basilicas of Italy, but rather to the ancient pagan grounds of Artemis herself. Ephesus, a stone's thrown away from Myra, had long been a center of mystical power and divine energy. The Temple of Artemis was a beacon to both pagans and early Christians. It was a place where the lines between deities blurred. Artemis was the virgin huntress. She was the goddess of childbirth and the protector of the vulnerable, and she bore uncanny similarities to Saint Nicholas's later role as a protector of children and sailors. We certainly do love our weird guys who creep in and inspect our children at night, don't we? Some early sects even merged Nicholas' cult with Artemis itself, blurring the boundary between saint and goddess. Now, when the sailors from Bari arrived in Myra, legend claims that they didn't sail directly to Italy. Instead, they veered off course to Ephesus, driven by these visions and superstitions. And there, in the shadow of this crumbling Artemis temple, they hid what they couldn't take. And possibly some of those things were the true bones of Saint Nicholas. The temple's crypt had been long abandoned and sealed by time, and it became a hidden resting place. Some believe that the saint's remains still lie beneath Ephesus, guarded by the spirits of the ancient world. Or indeed, maybe he himself was the physical manifestation of one of these spirits of the ancient world. Today, beneath the ruins of the Temple of Artemis, archaeologists have discovered strange tunnels and burial niches. What if his bones were deliberately concealed, not to protect them from pagans, but to align his power with that of Artemis? Or to imply that he was something far more sinister? Let me tell you a story that the church won't really speak of. It's kind of a tale of conspiracy. It has some very interesting historical ties that I consider credible. So the story began as most do with the Catholic Church, with death and witchcraft. And in the year 343 AD, St. Nicholas of Myra, the man who would become Santa Claus, drew his last breath. And he wasn't just a saint of sailors and children. He was a man of secrets, a protector of sacred knowledge. And even in life, strange rumors clung to him. Of gold coins appearing in the homes of the desperate, of sailors saved by a voice that no one else could hear, and of men who crossed him, vanishing without a trace. Nicholas wasn't just considered holy. He was powerful. There was something more to this being that we call Santa Claus. And after his death, his body was entombed in a humble grave beneath the church in Myra. But that tomb was more than a resting place. It became a focus of strange energy. It was a beacon, and pilgrims came from far and wide to this location. Centuries passed, and the winds began to shift, as they do. And in the 11th century, as the Seljuk Turks pushed deeper into Asia Minor, fear swept throughout the Christian world because Myra was vulnerable. And Nicholas's tomb, like we already discussed, was a symbol of protection and hope. So these Turks would no doubt come to pillage the church where St. Nick's bones were. But instead of the Italian sailors bringing the bones to Italy or leaving them in this temple of Artemis, instead, they were sort of given over and trusted to the unlikeliest of protectors, the Saracens. And it was said that Saracen mystics in the Seljuk courts believed Nicholas was no ordinary saint, and to them he was a figure from older myths. What a coincidence. A bridge between their world and something far more ancient. So now we're outside of Christianity altogether. And somehow, these Turks, these Saracens, know of this Saint Nicholas. They whispered that his relics held the power to sway the heavens and the sea. A man of Nicholas' gifts could not simply be destroyed. He had to be hidden. So the Saracens took his bones and concealed them deep in the desert, perhaps in the caverns beneath Mount Nemrut, perhaps in the forgotten tombs near Haran. For decades, Nicholas lay in the care of those whom the church called infidels, but not forever. By the late 12th century, a new player emerged, and you've all heard of them, the Knights Templar. To the public, the Templars were holy warriors, guardians of pilgrims, and protectors of the Holy Land. But beneath their white robes and red crosses, they were something else. They were a brotherhood of mystics, deeply entwined with esoteric knowledge from the East. The Templars knew of Nicholas' power, and some claimed that he appeared in their dreams and often spoke in riddles about hidden gold, forgotten relics, and the path to immortality. And according to the most cryptic records, the Templars struck a deal with Saracen mystics during the uneasy times of the Crusades. And in exchange for knowledge, or perhaps protection, the Saracens handed over the sacred bones of Saint Nicholas. But why would the Templars care about Nicholas, a saint known for giving gifts to children? Because Nicholas wasn't just a saint. He was believed to hold the secret of resurrection. Legends tied him to the Grail myth, to rituals that mirrored the ancient rites of Osiris, and to hidden texts that hinted at a path to eternal life. The Templars didn't just want relics. They sought dominion over death itself. And in their vaults beneath the Temple Mount, they kept Nicholas's bones alongside other artifacts whispered to be too powerful for mortal hands. Some say that they even mummified his head, just like they did with John the Baptist, and they kept it as a relic. Some say they experimented, attempting to revive the dead through the saint's relics. Others claim Nicholas's bones were ground into powder and consumed in sacred rituals, a belief that by ingesting even a fragment of the saint, they could extend their lives. And we can't forget that there was this idea that Saint Nick may have been a necromancer of types. And we'll get to that. But whatever the truth, Nicholas's bones vanished when the Templars fell in 1307. Some believe they were taken to Scotland, hidden beneath the Rosslyn Chapel. Others say fragments ended up in Venice or Bari, scattered to avoid discovery. What unites the Saracens and the Templars isn't faith, though. It's knowledge. Both groups shared an understanding that predates Christianity, a belief in the cycle of life, death, and rebirth. Nicholas, in their eyes, wasn't just a saint. He was a figure akin to Mithras, Osiris, or even Odin, a protector of hidden wisdom and a guide between worlds. This was no simple saint. And this explains why the modern image of Santa Claus, a jolly man with gifts, is just a mask. Beneath that red suit lies something older, a relic of the ancient gods who ruled over life and death. Perhaps this is why no grave of Nicholas exists today, at least none that are 100% agreed upon. Let me tell you a tale wrapped in more secrecy and greed, and the kind of ancient rituals that the Vatican keeps locked away in these shadowy archives they have. The story begins not in some distant desert or forgotten crypt, but in the very heart of the Catholic Church, with the desecration of St. Nicholas's body. And this is crazy. In the centuries after his death, Nicholas's tomb became a place of pilgrimage, like we've already discussed. But these pilgrims didn't just come for prayers. They came for the sacred oil. It was said that every year, on the anniversary of his death, a mysterious white liquid would seep from his bones, and the church called it manna, though it bore absolutely no resemblance to the biblical manna of the Israelites. This manna was thick, almost like resin, and it carried a sort of sweet, otherworldly aroma. To the faithful, it was a miracle, a proof that Nicholas's power persisted beyond death, and to the priest, it was something else entirely. It was a commodity. By the 9th century, rumors spread that the church wasn't just collecting this sacred manna, they were bottling it, they were selling it, and they were distributing it across all of Europe. Small glass vials marked with Nicholas's seal were sold to nobles, kings, and even rival churches, each one containing a drop of the saint's essence. But there was a problem. St. Nicholas's tomb only produced so much manna. Demand outstripped supply. And that's when the Vatican made a choice, one that would shatter this saint's legacy. In 1087 AD, under the cover of religious necessity, of course, Italian sailors from Bari weren't just tasked with saving Nicholas's bones from Seljuk invaders. No, they were sent by the Vatican to break open his tomb and harvest his remains. When they cracked the stone coffin in Myra, what they found was unlike anything the church had anticipated. Nicholas's body was eerily well preserved, and the white manna poured from his bones as if they bled oil. The sailors, allegedly, scooped up as much as they could, sealing it in some sort of clay vessels, and then the bones were pried from the tomb, stripped of their resting place, and hauled back. Not for veneration, but for extraction. Now, here's where the tale twists into conspiracy, because the church claimed the manna was divine, but not everybody believed that. And some scholars whispered that Nicholas had been buried not with holy relics, but with ancient substances, herbs, and other resins, or even materials linked to alchemical practices, because the dude was a necromancer, you see, and he was into alchemy. Others said that the manna was something more disturbing. It was the blood of the gods, spoken of in forgotten Greek texts, and it was believed to grant longevity, but it came at a cost. Those who consumed it too often were said to be driven to madness. Sounds a little bit like adrenochrome, doesn't it? And yet the church bottled it by the gallon. When Nicholas's remains reached Bari, they weren't placed gently beneath the altar of the Basilica di San Nicola. Instead, his bones were broken apart, cracked open to drain every last drop of this manna. and the relics that remained were splintered and sent to cathedrals across Europe. But the mana? The mana became a secret currency for a small amount of time, traded among the Vatican elite, used in ceremonies. They were never spoken of in public. Some whispered that popes, desperate to prolong their reigns, would drink the mana in secret rituals. Others believed it was used in coronations, mixed with oils to anoint kings and emperors, binding them not just to Christ, but to something older and darker. By the 13th century, of course, the supply dwindled, and Nicholas's bones ceased to produce the mana. The church claimed that the saint's power had finally faded, but the truth was far more unsettling. The last drops of mana were contaminated. Pilgrims who consumed it fell ill, and some even died in violent convulsions. The Vatican just quietly withdrew the vials from circulation, and to this day, in the crypt beneath Bari's Basilica, St. Nicholas's bones, allegedly, according to this story, lie in a glass case. But the air is thick with humidity, and sometimes, if you stand close enough, you can still see the faint shimmer of liquid pooling beneath the remains. But some say it's just water from the Adriatic seeping into the tomb. Others? Well, they say the mana is beginning to flow again, and if that's true, the church may once again be tempted to harvest what should have been left buried. There are also tales of Saint Nick bringing people back from the dead. Like we said before, this dude was a necromancer, and the accompanying strange and historical paintings feature alchemy symbols, implying that Saint Nick's power may not have been due to the glory of God after all. The tale of the three butchered children begins on a bitter winter's night, much like one I will experience tonight, and when the world was darker and crueler than it seemed. In the heart of a small village, nestled against the cold winds of Asia Minor, three young boys, who were lost and weary, knocked at the door of a butcher's shop. The butcher was a man with sharp eyes, but an even sharper knife, and he welcomed them inside with a twisted smile. His shop was dim, and the air was thick with the scent of salted meats hanging from the rafters. "We'll shelter ya," the butcher said, his voice warm like honey. But as the children sat by the fire, their bellies empty, the butcher's greed whispered to him. Meat was scarce that year. The famine had crept over the land, and with every passing day, fewer customers could afford his wares. Three plump boys could fetch a high price. And so, under the cover of night, the butcher did the unthinkable. He slaughtered the children like lambs, carving their bodies with the precision of a man who had done this before. He salted the flesh, packed the remains into a wooded barrel, and left them there, forgotten, hidden beneath layers of brine. But fate was not finished with him. Days passed, the snow fell heavy, and the village grew quiet under the weight of winter. One evening, the door to the butcher's shop creaked open. A figure stepped inside, wrapped in heavy robes, his breath curling like smoke in the cold air. His eyes, they say, pierced through the veil of the ordinary. He did not need to speak to know the truth, and as he gazed upon the barrels lined along the wall, he saw something the butcher prayed no one else would. Nicholas approached the barrels nearest the fire and laid his hand gently upon it. "Open it," he said, his voice quiet but firm. The butcher's face drained of color. His hands trembled as he lifted the lid, and there, packed tight beneath layers of salt, lay the pale limbs of the three children. Nicholas knelt beside the barrel. His lips moved in silent prayer, his fingers tracing the sign of the cross over the salted remains. And then, something impossible happened. The children's skin began to flush, color flooding back as if they had merely been sleeping. Slowly, limbs knit together, breath filled their lungs, and one by one, they stirred from death's embrace. The first boy sat up, rubbing his eyes as if waking from a dream. The second stretched his arms, yawning softly, and the third, the youngest, blinked and looked around, his voice breaking the silence. "I'm cold."
"Hmm.
And this is one of the main stories surrounding this whole necromancer thing, because there's a lot of people who seem to believe that Saint Nick was able to bring back people from the dead. And when you look at some of the imagery, you see him next to alchemy symbols. And knowing that he was probably a little bit more than just a Catholic saint, and that he could bring people back from the dead, and that he was probably dabbling in other esoteric knowledge, I don't think it's very far-fetched of an idea to believe that Saint Nick maybe not was not a good guy. There is one story that I really liked about Saint Nick, and it's one of the stories where he is more of a good guy, and he was called to oversee the invention of the Christmas tree. Of course, that's not the way it went down. What actually happened is that he was called to a location where cypress trees were being cut down, and that's what Christmas trees originated as. And they were cut down en masse in this location because of all the demons that were living in the cypress trees. So this obviously gives Saint Nick a little bit more of a sort of, you know, supernatural TV show monster hunter sort of vibe, and that's pretty cool for Christmas. So listen, I'm not here to be no Grinch. I do enjoy talking about the reality of things, though. I hope you all have an excellent holiday season, each and every one of you. I will see you in 2025. Don't drink the water and question everything.